My name is Ed Martin. I'm the director of the Center for Interfaith Engagement. My associate director is Gretchen Most over here. And we have a program associate, John Fairfield, in the back there. And we're very happy to begin our monthly series of interfaith forums. And I'm really excited about the speaker that we were able to line up for today, Dr. Vanessa Oakes from the University of Virginia, where she teaches in the Department of Religious Studies and in the Jewish Studies program. And I'm not going to say much more about her, except I found her academic or study background, educational background, very interesting, with a bachelor's degree in drama and French from Tufts University, a Master of Fine Arts in Theater from Sarah Lawrence College, and a PhD in the Anthropology of Religion from Drew University. So it's quite an interesting background, I think. And the other thing I wanted to say is I've had the privilege of hearing Dr. Oakes speak a couple times on various issues related to Jewish culture and Jewish practices, and found her very interesting, very stimulating. And for that reason, I was very interested in having her come over here. I'll tell a secret about her. She told me when she walked in today that it was her first time in Harrisonburg. And we hope to have her back more often. And so, Vanessa, thank you for coming, and we look forward to hearing your presentation.
I was worried when you said that you were going to share a secret. Because we've been around the world together. John and Ed and I were together in Dubai teaching, studying and teaching and learning together. So I thought there were all kinds of secrets that could possibly be revealed. I thank you very much for bringing me here. You do such important work, sacred work, work that's highly generative of all kinds of possibilities, and I'm just very feel very lucky to be in your midst. Please let me know if you can hear me, and if you can't, I probably can't speak much louder, but you could move forward. And that would, so this would be the time that if you think you're going to have trouble hearing me, I have a very little voice, and if you'd like to move forward, please be invited to do so. Thank you so much. Thank you. Just the other day, a woman from the Russian Orthodox community came to my office for a consultation. She said that she knew that Jewish feminists have made a great deal of progress in bringing change and transformation into their community. These last 30, 40 years, and she was wondering if she could try out some ideas with me, and I felt very, very, very hopeful that we might be able to work productively together. And I said, well, what kinds of changes have you had so far in your community? And she wanted to speak about liturgy in particular. And she said, well, for many years there was a prayer for safe travel on the sea and on the land. And she said then there was a tremendous controversy about whether in the air could be added. And she said eventually there was. I said, that's the progress you've made. Yeah. I said, well, we have our work cut out for us. And I tried to come up with some ideas that might work, that might be helpful as she began to organize with others in her church to create a more capacious place for women to be welcome and in an expressive kind of way. Jewish feminists would not be where they are right now in their accomplishments if not for our conversation with Christian feminist scholars and practitioners. It would be impossible for us to have done what we did and what we are doing without the inspiration and modeling of women in other communities. And so I come to you today to share what we have done in my community with for a variety of reasons, both as a way of saying thanks, thanks for the head start, and also by way of saying, look, we've got certain, we've accomplished some things that maybe might be useful to you in your communities, and there are certain issues that we continue to have, and I put them out there, in case now or at some later time, you or members in your community might be able to continue to lend a hand to us. As I speak today, as I promised to Ed, I will try and explain anything one needs to know in Jewish tradition in order for my presentation to make sense. But if at some point I just assume that something is as commonplace as a matzo ball or as familiar as chutzpah, or as well-known as the Passover Seder, considering it takes place in the White House these last 3 years, just let me know. As is probably familiar, Judaism, until the most recent of times, has traditionally been a male-centered tradition. And we have here a picture of a bris, of the ceremony for, or a brit milah, the ceremony for the welcome of a baby boy into the Jewish tradition. You see that the baby boy is being held by a mohel, an official community circumciser. His father is standing behind with the glasses and about to like pass out a little bit. It's his firstborn son. He is standing behind the mohel, who is acting on behalf of the father to do this task. Sitting before the mohel in the left corner is the grandfather of the little boy. The mohel will put the baby in the grandfather's lap, and the grandfather will hold him as the ceremony is taking place. The other grandfather sits on the other side. He'll be holding him later and saying blessings. We see a grandma sort of hovering in the back, and we see another woman also doing a little side hover. In this ceremony, this is a welcome to the guys' club ceremony. And until the 1970s, there was not an equivalent ceremony for the baby girl. Not that Jewish girls are not loved, but when baby boys are born, there has been a great celebration. I should add that the word for memory in Hebrew, to remember, zachor, is the same word for zachar, which is masculinity. So there's a connection between remembrance and the male member, who has a male member, who is the one who remembers and transmits. And what is being inscribed upon this little baby boy with his circumcision is membership into the covenant. And so women may well ask, don't we belong? Or what does it mean when half the group belongs with a sign and half the group doesn't? It's like who gets to wear the t-shirt and who doesn't? This is my Aunt Phyllis, and she is posing for this picture. She's getting ready she's a very happy, cheerful person. Just to tell the truth here, she's a happy, cheerful person. And while she's standing here unpacking her Passover groceries, Uncle Neil is standing on the dining room table cleaning the crystals of the chandelier by dipping them into sudsy water one by one. So just to be truthful about this picture. However, my Aunt Phyllis did want to model the lot of the traditional lot of the Jewish woman for me, who is sort of stuck in the kitchen and busy taking care of everybody. In In legal parlance, a Jewish woman is responsible for three mitzvot, three commandments that are women, there are others that she's responsible for that everyone needs to observe, the Sabbath, caring for the poor, caring for the elderly, holidays, and so forth. But there are three particular commandments that are considered women's commandments. One is when the challah, the bread for the Sabbath is being made, the woman needs to pick off a little portion and burn it in the memory of the priestly sacrifice in the ancient temple, which is a ritual that men do not perform. The other ritual is to light the Sabbath candles, which is a very important ritual because it designates when holy time begins, and it's lit in the house, and the house in Jewish tradition, as many of you know, the house is considered as much a sanctuary, as much a holy space as any other place. And the other role that the woman is responsible for is obeying the laws of menstrual purity, which mean that for 7 days while she menstruates, she and her husband do not have relations for 7 more days, and then her obligation is to dip into a bath called a mikveh, a special ritual bath, not unlike a baptismal font, but a big one, a really big one where your whole body can go in and dip under. And after this immersion, she and her husband can once again resume sexual relations. Jewish ritual objects, and I picked just one, Jewish ritual objects tend to display male memory. And we have here the shank bone on the Passover plate, which recalls the sacrifice of the Paschal lamb, which generally the head of the household, the male, would bring to the priest, the Levite priest, the males, who would sacrifice it, and it would be brought back to the household. The rest of the symbols are discussed by the male rabbis in the Mishnah and the Talmud concerning their usage on at the Passover Seder. So the most traditional Jewish ritual objects come out of male memory and male legal decision making. Enter the modern day, and we see certain changes taking place. Now, the book that I'm writing right now happens to be on the Passover Haggadah, and perhaps sometime I'll speak to you about the tremendous changes that have taken place in the last 20 years or so concerning Passover observance, such as a ritual of including olives on the Seder plate, signs of peace in the Middle East, but for at this moment I want to focus on the change of the orange on the Seder plate. When the orange initially appeared on a Seder plate, it reflected that lesbian women belonged in Judaism and should be honored and included as much as everybody else. It was taken over by feminists as a sign that women belonged in Passover observance, women belonged in synagogues and in liturgical participation as much as men as well. And there are all kinds of stories about that are told, some apocryphal, some not. But as we can see symbolically on our Passover table, there are now signs of change that have taken place in Judaism in the last years. A truly important precursor to the Jewish women's movement, to Jewish feminism as it's sometimes called, was the 1960s women's movement. And it should not be a surprise that many of the leaders in the women's movement happened to have been Jewish political or scholarly or social activists who embraced a tradition of activism from their mothers and grandmothers. Among those, Gloria Steinem and Letty Pogrebin, who were the co-founders of Ms. Magazine, Betty Friedan, the author of The Feminine Mystique. And all of these women do speak of a sense that they knew that in Judaism, whether they were secular or coming from observant families, they knew that women were given housewifely roles in their tradition and excluded in many ways, yet they all did recall, particularly those who had immigrant mothers and grandmothers, they recalled the strength of character, and the strength as an agent of charitable doing and organization in the community of these women who came before them. What were some of the issues, just to refresh our memory or to to note it for younger folks, the issues of the 1960s women's movement had to do with women's rights in the workplace, equal pay, and equal opportunities for women to take all kinds of roles. And I do remember my mother having this conversation where my father was asked, would you ever go to a woman doctor? And he said, you know, only if there was no one else and my life depended upon it. And you know, this was the kind of conversation that in the 1960s someone could get away with, particularly because there were no women doctors in our neighborhood. It wasn't something that he could actually even imagine. Yes, all of his doctors now are women, I'm happy to say. When he has a male doctor, he says he's a nice male doctor. Just like, good dad, good for you. Just to point out that men can do it, that's good. Another issue that was very large at that time was who was going to do work in the house, dividing up housework, who was going to take care of the children, and tremendous emphasis on women's health. Those were the years of Our Bodies, Ourselves. Anyone who remembers Our Bodies, Ourselves? Okay, the first magazine where women were given just knowledge about how to take care of issues concerning birth control, issues concerning childbirth, and issues about menstruation, menopause, where there's knowledge out there for women to take care of themselves. This was the backdrop. There were experiences, social experiences, and emotional experiences that were characteristic of this era as well. And these also played into the founding generation of Jewish feminism. One social experience was the consciousness raising session, where women would get together, typically in homes, and would talk about their personal unhappinesses. Hence, from this era, the personal is political. That sense that what you're experiencing, your own happiness, is not so private, not so shameful, that you can't talk about it. And when you bring it out into the air and share it with others, you realize that it speaks to inequalities in a system and not just your own matters. Women who came to these sessions found strength together in sisterhood and began to realize that personal experience not only could be expressed, but personal experience when shared had weight, that experience was a source of knowing as valid as the knowing that came from book learning. In this era, women scholars, women in the academy, who really struggled a great deal to be able to study issues concerning women, and there are so many of women who are just a little bit older than I am, so women, you know, maybe women 10 years older, women in their 60s, who would say that if they tried in the history department or in the religion department to write on a topic concerning women's history, we're always told by their advisors, if you write about that, no one will take you seriously. And this was the era before women's studies programs, and that was going on all the time. But when women began to work in the academy, the notion of essentialism became an issue that was discussed. That is to say, do women have a nature that all women have? Do men have a nature that all men have? That was one topic, this issue of essentialism. Another notion was the issue of gender as being socially constructed. That is, one is that feminine ways or masculine ways are not the ways that one is born with, but rather one learns how to be a woman, one learns how to be a man, one society teaches one how to express oneself correctly according to particular mannerisms. Another phrase of that time that was large was gender as a gender being on a continuity. I think that was the phrase that was used. That sense that there are all different kinds of ways of being a man, different kinds of ways of being a woman, and that people would in their own personal lives would express themselves in masculine ways in some way, or feminine, in sort of socially feminine ways in different kinds of contexts. This was the era when women's studies departments were first being created. And in those days, in the late 1960s, it was not uncommon to ask the question, but were there any women artists? Were there any women artists who were any good? And you know, now certainly we have found those women. We have found those women worthies, and we have written about important women in history. But at the same time, it was important for feminist scholars to in asking the question, where are the women, to also write down and explore the lives of everyday women. Real women, ordinary women, illiterate women, half the population whose lives would be glossed over when telling the story of a nation, when that story would focus only on the founding fathers, the masters of invention, the creators of war. So that was, again, part of the background. So what were some of the issues that Jewish women in the late 60s and early 70s were wrestling with? For one, there were no public leaders who were women. Not a rabbi, not a cantor, that is the synagogue singer, not a renowned Torah scholar, someone versed in Torah or the rabbinic texts, Mishnah and Talmud, not even a president of a synagogue, not a leader of any of the denominations, the Reform, the Conservative, or the Orthodox denominations, and very, very few scholars in Jewish studies in academia. In the 1970s, I went once with my husband to an Association for Jewish Studies meeting, and it looked just like a yeshiva, a school for Jewish men. There were no women, maybe one or two or three women to be found. Now I'm happy to say the Association for Jewish Studies has had numerous women as its president, and I'm happy to be on several of its boards right now. Something that in those days I certainly never could have imagined would be possible. What roles were open for women? Being a transmitter of Judaism to one's children in one's home, keeping that home, making that home lively, having sensually vibrant holidays in one's home, being a teacher of Jewish children, a rabbi's wife, being the president of the sisterhood, a member of Hadassah, and none of these are unimportant roles. I mean, these are clearly all crucial roles in the transmission of Jewish culture, and also the and also exercising a lot of Jewish social service work in the community in America, abroad, and in Israel as well. However, these were always seen as subordinate kinds of roles, not where the action was. There were limited spiritual opportunities for women as well. Women played absolutely no liturgical roles in the public sphere. So a little girl might be praying with her class, but she would never be leading those prayers. Certainly, women were not counted in the prayer quorum of 10 men, which would be necessary in order to read from the Torah or to say certain very important prayers. Women would not be standing in front of congregations reading the Torah on the Sabbath or during the weekday or holiday Torah readings. They would never be called up to the Torah for honors. And a very difficult limitation was that women were not often invited or included in the saying of Kaddish, the mourner's prayer. To be able to say that prayer on someone's behalf is seen as a great responsibility that one fulfills for one's parent. One of the greatest responsibilities in praying for that person's soul as long as you live. It's also a mending kind of activity that one engages in, certainly right after a death, when one says it for a whole year each day, but also when one says that prayer in an annual kind of way. And women were excluded from the saying of that prayer. Can you bear more problems? In Orthodox services, men and women were separated, which would not have been so bad, except for the fact that certainly if genders want to separate for prayers and focus more on their relationship with the prayer than with each other, would not have been so bad if the women had not been in a balcony behind a grate or a heavy curtain, or not so bad if they weren't in this small, hot section closed off and airless. Not a surprise, when women were in the balconies or when women were in their little section, what were they mostly doing? They were mostly chit-chatting. Because why wouldn't you chit-chat if you couldn't see what was going on and you couldn't hear what was going on and you weren't being called upon? As we all know, those of us who lead, who have rich prayer lives, when you're obligated to do a prayer and called upon to do a prayer, you're there. You do it. You're prepared. You study it. You invest yourself in it. When your prayer life isn't considered necessary or important, you don't deepen it. You take it as seriously as the others take it. That is not too seriously at all. Other issues is that women were not given opportunities to have public rites of passage. That is, no ceremony for the birth of girl babies and no ceremony for bat mitzvah. That is the ritual of coming of age. And I recall this, my older daughter was born in 1979. It's my first child. We lived upstate New York. And if she had been a boy, and this was October, all of my relatives from near and far would have come up if we were holding a circumcision for her. As it was, We perform the ritual for our new friends. We had just moved to Hamilton, New York. We perform the ritual in the company of our new friends in that community, and no family came whatsoever. 4 years later, when her sister was born, and I had grown stronger as a Jewish feminist, and there were more liturgies going around for the naming ceremonies of Jewish girls, I said to my parents, "You will come. You will be here." And to their credit, they were. Other issues in which Jewish women felt absences: there was no liturgical garb for women. The prayer shawl, which I brought one along, and this is a particular one that I'll be telling you about a little bit later. This is called a tallit, and it's worn like so, as one prays. Sometimes it's thrown over the shoulders a little bit if it's a large one. There was no tallit for women to wear, this emblematic sign of the Jew at prayer. There was no yarmulke. There was no head covering or kippah. And thus, if someone were to draw a picture of a Jew, generally one would draw a man wearing a kippah, wearing a prayer shawl, perhaps having a beard. And the question was, is a woman a Jew if no one pictures her as one? Essentially, and I'll just skip some of these, essentially a woman's role in Judaism in too many essential parts of life, in the synagogue and in her own marriage, was passive. And let me tell you a little bit about the Jewish wedding ceremony. Who's been to a Jewish wedding ceremony? A few of you. You've probably seen a document signed called a ketubah. And you might think that the bride and groom are both signing that document, and they're both vowing all kinds of nice things to each other. That is not the case in the traditional ketubah. And yes, you can go online right now and find all kinds of lovely, lovely, with it, cool same-sex marriage ketubahs, interfaith ketubahs, egalitarian ketubahs. There's even, I've seen on several websites, a non-Jewish ketubah. For those non-Jews who have been to Jewish weddings and see ketubahs and think, I want that too. As a matter of fact, non-Jews are also using the chuppah at their weddings. The Jewish wedding canopy are holding up the bride and groom on chairs. We share. We do want to share the good stuff. But the traditional ketubah, what is that about? It says that the husband acquires the woman's sexual fidelity. He acquires access to her soul, access to her body. And in exchange for that, he promises her to offer her shelter, to offer her support. And this is actually a nifty part of the ketubah and a nifty part of Jewish tradition that's been there for many, 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 many generations, is that he promises her sexual fulfillment. And the Talmud has very specific laws about what that means. If you're a sailor at sea, once a year. If you live out of town and travel, once a month. If you are a Torah scholar, every day. So there's a bright side to it. Going back to the negatives, Jewish women looking at, Jewish feminists looking at the actual content of the ketubah and the practice of a woman being acquired, essentially, saw something is wrong with this, because the woman in the case of the ketubah, the Jewish wedding, is totally passive. she's acquired, and the only way she can move on and marry someone else in the case of divorce is if her husband takes the initiative and writes a document, a writ of divorce called a get. And if he doesn't give this to her, she's just stuck. He can go on and remarry, but she can't, and this remains an issue in certain communities. Jewish feminists turn to the Bible for sources of strength and also sources of problems. If we go right to Genesis, we turn to an interesting midrash, an interesting rabbinic legend. And you perhaps you know the name Lilith either from the musical festival or from the character on Frasier or from a Jewish magazine called Lilith, which is the first Jewish feminist magazine. There is a rabbinic midrash in which Adam had a wife previous to Eve named Lilith. And she wanted to have sex any which way she pleased. To be on top, that would be, I guess, the term that was used. And in this midrash, or she, for her desire to be equal, is chased out of the Garden of Eden. And she's demonized as someone who endangers babies, and one needs to have amulets of protection against her. So this sense of this anti-woman or fear of women or fear of powerful women is coded into reading of the Bible. In many women who were looking to the Bible for strength, while they did see certain female role models, they also could not help but notice that most women in the Bible are important as wives and mothers. And if there is a reward for their being good or persistent, it is that their barrenness is overcome and they get to be mothers. So we don't see, I mean, yes, there are certain wonderful exceptions, Deborah the judge, Esther the queen, who have strength and leadership that has nothing to do with being mothers. They are not the key figures, and we do see, and this is certainly very troubling, in the Bible, figures like Tamar, Esther, and Ruth, the way that they are able to advance in the systems in which they inhabit and bring justice or bring on a messianic era or save their people. It is done in a subversive kind of way, and it's done by their using their bodies. In essence, they need to prostitute themselves, or not in the case of Ruth, but she needs to, Ruth has to seduce Boaz in the night in order to become his wife and the mother of his child. In essence, we see that in reading in most of Torah, even when there is a powerful woman, she becomes silenced. And this, we have a picture here of Miriam's cup. And I think that Miriam, of all characters in Bible, in Torah, is the one whose silence is silencing, is so very disturbing. Miriam, as we know, Moses' sister in the book of Exodus, saves his life, protects him. She leads the women across the sea when they escape from Egypt, and has said to the women that they must be optimistic and bring with them timbrels and drums because they will be dancing when they reach the other side. When she later on, in while they're wandering, while the Jewish people, the Israelites are wandering through the desert, what happens one day? Aaron and Miriam speak out against Moses' wife. We don't know exactly how it is, what it is they spoke about. In some of the Midrash, we actually read that Miriam felt that Moses had taken a vow of abstinence and was no longer available to his wife. No, we don't know. But what happens as a consequence of Miriam and Aaron speaking out? Miriam comes down with skin disease, and she is kept outside the camp. And while it's true that the people wait for her until she has healing, she is the one who's separated from the people and not her brother Aaron. And essentially, we really don't hear from Miriam ever again as a prophet. Back in the early 70s, when there was this feeling, a strong feeling among many young Jewish women who were touched by the women's movement, who had been raised often in Jewish youth groups and in synagogues with good educations, there was this feeling that, are we allowed to share, to speak about our dissatisfactions, or do we have to be nice Jewish girls and be quiet? And just to run down this list, because I think it's to me it's useful, because it explains why I think one can extrapolate and wonder why are women silent in other traditions. In the case of Jewish women, well, I'll be quiet because that's things have always been this way. It's tradition. Or number two, well, it's the will of God. It must be how God wants it, or that it must say it someplace in the Bible, or this defensiveness, like, well, I can't reveal that my sources of discontent come from the outside, come from a political movement. A very noble kind of anxiety about one's, which fuels one's repression, would be this fear that if I say all the things that are troubling me about my tradition, it will endanger fragile Judaism, which felt particularly fragile after the Holocaust, in the years after the Holocaust. The sense that if there were internal embroilments, internal critique, that it was coming at a bad time. The next category is this anxiety that if Jews said anything bad about Judaism, non-Jews would hear it and would use it against Jews. Another source of repression would be respect for one's elders. If I were to criticize how Jewish women are treated, it would be disrespectful of how my mother and grandmother live their life, and how my father and grandfather live their life as well. And certainly there was fear. The fear of men who were in power, the fear of male rage, the fear of male rebuke, and possibly the fear that if one put one's concerns out in public, that nothing would happen at all. Theology was an issue that Judith Plaskow, whose name you may know, a very important Jewish feminist theologian, theology was an issue that needed to be wrestled with as well. It's not just what goes on in the synagogue. It's not just what goes on in the house of study. It's not just what goes on in rituals. Jewish feminists were beginning to realize that there were theological reasons, theological rationales, for why women had a subservient role. And certainly, just to give one example, the most common Jewish prayer, if you've heard Jewish blessings, Baruch Atah Adonai Eloheinu Melech Olam, blessed are thou, O Lord our God, King of the universe, who has commanded us. All of these words suggest a powerful male God, perhaps in a feudal system, the God who is king, far away, outside, overlooking the universe, the God who commands. And some of the earliest feminist theologians, and this was in the Christian world before it came to the Jewish world, Nell Morton was a very important Protestant theologian whose work was very important to Judith Plaskow, that sense of what about the possibility of a different kind of understanding of the deity, not a transcendent deity who is above and commanding, but an immanent God, a God around, a God among, a God who is with, a God who experiences and feels, not necessarily a God who judges, but a God of compassion and empathy. And not to say that none of these characteristics are present in Jewish theological understanding, but they certainly had not previously been emphasized or brought to the attention of men and women to bolster certain human qualities. What are some of the accomplishments of Jewish women who were able to organize? An organization was key. This was not done by any one woman. And certainly there was some impetus in the reform movement, which had already, and conservative movement, which had already taken the step of men and women sitting together in prayer. And that was sort of as far as they had gone. The first accomplishment was in the Reform movement and the Reconstructionist movement as well, smaller movement, was to train women as rabbis, to allow women to be in the same seminaries as men and not to take different kinds of degrees for the same kind of coursework, but to receive ordination. It was very difficult for that first generation of women to get posts in synagogues, and my father also said I could never imagine a woman rabbi. And even this past year, I know he was on liturgical committee in his conservative synagogue, and there was one female candidate to be the cantor, and he said to me, I just couldn't. I mean, I think she didn't get voted in for a number of reasons, but my father said to me, I just couldn't picture it. I just couldn't imagine it. The imagination is the strength of one's imagination is a strong barrier to social change. And this is Sally Prizand, the first Reform woman to be a rabbi, and she has since she has had a full and rich career and has recently retired. Another change was the construction of new liturgies. And Marcia Falk was a great leader. Marcia Falk, a poet and translator, was a great leader in trying to come up with ideas of how could the traditionally male patriarchal literature be reframed. And the earliest experiments had, "Blessed are you, Lord our God, Queen of the universe," or instead of "God he, God she." And early on, people realized, you know something? Let's not feed into the anthropomorphosis. Let's not build a pantheon of chicks. Why do that? And Marcia Falk came up with new language for prayer. And instead of the "Blessed are you, Lord our God, King of the universe," she came up with a very interesting structure, which was communal, which spoke of God not as the king and ruler, but as a source, and spoke of God being among us using the locution, let us bless the source of life, and so we are blessed, creating more of an imminent circle of blessing. And her work has been used and adopted in many prayer books. The ritual bath that women were dipping into on their own has now, in certain communities, been used for men and women both to mark passages of life. Wedding ceremonies have been changed so in certain communities so that that the man doesn't acquire the woman and the woman doesn't acquire the man, where there isn't this mutual acquisition, but rather Rachel Adler created a ceremony which has been being used by many now, and when I performed a wedding recently, I used it and I felt, gee, this really feels right. It's a ceremony of covenanting in which both the man and the woman use a ring to symbolize that they have entered into a covenant with each other, a covenant with particular obligations and responsibilities, just as God entered into a covenant with Abraham and God entered into a covenant with the Jewish people. Partnership minyanim, which is something that I write at the very bottom of that list, is the most stunning change in Jewish practice that I have seen in my life. And I saw it maybe 7-8 years ago in Jerusalem at a synagogue that was founded by the daughter of an influential liberal Orthodox rabbi named David Hartman at the Shalom Hartman Institute. This is an Orthodox synagogue. Now, I just sat there and cried. I just could not believe in my lifetime that I was seeing this. It was a synagogue that had a partition between the men and the women. It was exactly to the ruler equal. The place where the Torah is read from and prayers are said was smack in the middle. And when women would go up to pray, they would stand on the women's side, and men would stand on the men's side, and they would take turns leading prayers. They would take turns reading from the Torah, took turns giving sermons. During the sermon, the curtain between men and women would be fully pushed aside. I just could not believe my eyes. There are still certain prayers that only men say in these communities, but they're very few. And in the Orthodox synagogue of late, women have been ordained as rabbis. Again, this is something that I never expected to see in my lifetime. They're very few, but now the Shalom Hartman Institute in Israel right now specifically has a track for the ordination of women who are rabbis, and there's a rabbinical school in America where this is done. And now I just want to share some good images with you, some happy images, before I land in a difficult one again, to show you where we are right now. So here we see, you remember that picture of the male, the ceremony welcoming the boy. Here we have a synagogue, we have images of a simchat bat or a brit habat. There are all kinds of different names for it. And these ceremonies are held not just in the liberal communities in America, but they have been so popularized that even among ultra-Orthodox communities in America and Israel, they are held. We have on the right side, we have a bar mitzvah, the coming of age for a boy. We see the bat mitzvah, the ceremony for the girl who comes of age at 12 or 13. We see a man wearing the prayer straps, and here we see Barbie, who is a Jewish girl, wearing not only the prayer straps, but she's wearing a talit as well. This was made jokingly by a woman rabbi once, to be enjoyed by her friends, but it was passed around. As a result, I feel very strongly of the work done in among Jewish feminists, inclusion for gay, lesbian, bi, and transgender people has become more and more taken up in a variety of Jewish communities. Of late, same-sex ceremonies are now being performed in conservative and reform communities. I'm sad to say that it took so long, but now gay people are students and ordinees in all the seminaries, but the Orthodox seminaries at this moment. An issue where we're struggling, and this is a picture in Jerusalem. In the center of this picture is Anat Hoffman, and to her left is an Israeli medical student, Nofrat Frankel. Anat was arrested on that day at the wall, at the Western Wall, which is considered by many to be the holiest site for Jews, the holiest site in Jerusalem, a remaining wall of the ancient that had sort of a rampart around the ancient temple. Anat was arrested for the crime of having a Torah, possessing a Torah with the intention of reading it at the wall. I'll just give you a little bit of history. Can I have about 5 more minutes? Okay.
Sure.
Okay. A little bit of history. In the late 1980s, there was the Jewish, I mean, like any other community, there are intercommunal bickerings. And a source of bickering in the late 80s was what was being called the "who is a Jew" issue. Whose conversion is considered a legitimate conversion for the sake of marriage in Israel or for the sake of citizenship in Israel. And there was a conference, I believe in 88, of Jewish feminists. And the Jewish women were of all denominations. And they thought, you know something, let us demonstrate as women that we can all pray together. We can come together and pray together, have a service to pray together. It was not easy. Just because they were all women didn't mean that they could all figure it out immediately who was going to compromise what in order to be able to pray together. It's just sort of, if I said to you, you're all Christians, you know, Mennonites and Catholics, you can all pray together. It's not, so it wasn't easy. But they figured it out, and they went to the wall to pray. And the reaction, and they were on the woman's side, and they were praying respectfully and quietly. The reaction was metal chairs were thrown to them over from the men's side. Epithets were hurled. It was a violent response. They returned to pray in that way again. The response was violent again. And the response of the government was not to silence those who would terrorize the women praying in this spot, but rather to make women's prayer illegal at the wall. It became illegal, and this took a number of years I was part of this group, and we were battling it out in the Israeli Supreme Court. It became illegal for a woman to wear a tallit, to wear a prayer shawl at the Western Wall, to pray out loud, or to read from the Torah. The government believed it was trying to work together with the powerful religious parties. They thought they would create a lovely compromise by creating a prayer space for women to pray in the archaeological gardens over at a place called Robinson's Arch, which it functionally is connected to the ancient temple in the way that the Western Wall is, but it historically has not been, a sacred site of the Jewish people. So they said, you can pray there. That's nice, right? You can pray there along with men and women who want to pray together. Well, the Women of the Wall, as this group came to be known, that's not what they had been fighting for all these years. the right to be Jewish women, to pray as Jewish women, to do the thing that you would want your Jewish child to do, to be a serious prayer, to go to the Western Wall, to read from the Torah. That wasn't their goal in the first place. So what the women do now is they pray very quietly together as a group at the way back of the Western Wall in the women's area. And they once a month for the new moon. And then they go over to the to this area, where to the Robinson's Arch area, where they finish up the service aloud. I was with this group in August with 26 of my students. It was my first time praying at the wall. The wall isn't kind of my kind of place. I've been a director of this group and an organizer and a supporter and a writer because my sisters asked me, my sisters and who are Jewish feminists asked me to do this. And of course I said yes, and I've worked very, very hard. But the wall isn't my place to pray, and as a liberal Jew, I don't generally prefer to pray among women only. But here I was in Jerusalem with my students, and I needed to show them what was going on, and I needed their support. The women of the wall have been praying at the wall for 20 years now, more than 20 years actually. It will be soon 25. And each time they pray, there's always the fear that the police will harass them in some way. So I was there in August with my students, and it happened to have been a peaceful time. Women were wearing prayer shawls that looked like this. And this was a prayer shawl that was made specifically for the women of the wall. As you see the same pattern on the Torah scroll. It has on each corner the names of one of the matriarchs, Sarah, Rebecca, Rachel, and Leah. And so these have been worn by members of the group and also by those who would support, who would buy them and wear them in the States at solidarity services. And the police had decided that these were the kinds of prayer shawls that offended the male worshipers on the other side. In effect, this is what the government has allowed the religious party to do that's in control of this area. It's allowed that party to say, the way that we pray is the right way to pray. And the way the women want to pray is an aberration. And so our women who were wearing these other kinds of prayer shawls were arrested and they were fined. And the words that were used for their crimes were avon and fesha, which are, I guess those are the translations of different kinds of crimes that one can commit in Israeli law. But they're also the crimes, the sins that are, they're the words that are used on Yom Kippur, on the Day of Atonement, for our pesha'im, our chata'im, the sins that we have committed before God, or sins that we have committed before man, and I'm thinking, before mankind, humankind, and I'm thinking to myself, for these harsh words to be used against Jewish women who are expressing themselves in prayer, in pious, traditional ways, granted not traditional according to gender, but to have these words used to describe what women are doing, for them to be threatened with imprisonment and fined, seems to be so harsh. So we have been in court for many, many years, and I really need to tell you how much I have the greatest respect I have for our Israeli women who were there month after month, not just on beautiful August and September days, July, August, and September days, but they're there when it's dark in the morning and it's rainy, and on the rare days in Jerusalem when it's snowy. They are always there. They are always saying that Jewish women belong here. And when I think of how difficult their experience is, it makes me feel connected to spiritual women, religious women around the world who are, despite governments or despite institutions that will not allow the women to express themselves spiritually and have agency over their spiritual lives, that they still persist and find ways of staying connected to God, to their liturgies, and still find ways to love their tradition despite the ways that those traditions can sometimes diminish them. So when you're in Jerusalem, if you happen to be in Jerusalem, and it's the new moon, do show up and nod at the women of the wall and give them a sign of strength, and hope for them, and hope that that younger women, my students, will figure out ways to work within the legal system in Israel to assure the rights of Jewish women. So I thank you so much for letting me describe my tradition to you. And again, I return to the place I began without cross-traditional conversation. I would not have had any of those happy pictures to show you. Thank you, and I'll be happy to answer questions.
Well, thank you so much, Vanessa, for all that you've shared with us today. It was very informative, very revealing. I'm so happy that you made the trip over to Harrisonburg. And we have a little time for some questions. We're going to be using a mic here, a roving mic, and it's going to be a little different situation than usual. We're going to ask you to speak into the mic, but you're not going to hear us using it because it's feeding into the film that's being made, or the recording. So we will ask you, as you ask a question, to use the mic, but realize that it's not projecting in the room.
You mean your voice is naturally that loud?
So.
That's impressive.
So, question. Mansoor. Speak into the mic.
Thanks for your good presentation. I'm coming from Muslim community, and we share some experiences, the same experiences in some countries. But as we go back to our Quran or the leaders' speeches, which is been kept up to now, and in some countries like Iran, when the people started digging out those literatures, they found that the interpretation of the what's being written there has been misinterpreted by male dominant community. So still in some Arab countries or in some Muslim countries, they do the same. Actually, they do the same tradition as you describe for Jewish women. But in some countries like Iran, we see the right of women, which being held, is more than men. For example, the wife shouldn't work at home. If she works, the male has to pay for her if she asks for it. Or even if she decides not to work, it's not her duty. So the husband should find a servant for her. There is no right for her to do cooking, no obligation for her to do cooking, doing home works, like something like that. The only thing is just even if she breastfeeding the baby, the husband should pay for that if she asks for it. Mm-hmm. So even for that one, which is that just the women character, mm-hmm. should mm-hmm. even she has to be paid for that. And if she decides to go out and work, all her salary or her earning belongs to her and shouldn't be spent in common life. But that's the rules we've got in our tradition, but miscalculated or misinterpreted by male dominant interpreter in our community. But what happened in last 20, 30 years, we had the same movement in Iran, and the women decided to have the same rights as a men. So what's happened in Iran now? We used to have very strong families. The wife was in house, and she tries to nurture the children, to educate them. But now, the same as here, in the morning, they have to wake up the children, put them in a nursery or a school, and ask the teachers there to do their job. And the wife goes for just getting money. And actually, this kind of asking for right has come to a point that the number of divorced families in Iran is going very, very sharply high. And the main problem is now that women feel that they want to the same right as the women, as the men. They want to be the truck drivers. And so when they go out and they leave that part which has been solely designated to them, the families we've got now in Iran, they are going the same way as we see the families here in the West. Just my question, I've got two questions. Is it the same in Jewish tradition? Didn't you have access to the old transcripts so you could go there and interpret that as into the right direction? And the second one, has the same changes been applied to Jewish community and now you've got
great.
The same families?
They're wonderful questions. Let me speak about the first one. I think one of the great changes for women in Islam and women in Judaism is that women have become scholars. Women have achieved the status of scholars and have gained the ability to read traditional texts that in years past they could only have access to if a man, if a husband, if a teacher read it and interpreted it to them. So they could be told, well, it says in scripture, it says in Quran, and what are they going to do? And certainly in Judaism, the way that women have been able to make change is by carefully reading scripture and rabbinic literature in order to see how much what past traditions there were that gave more power and agency to women, or to see that there were simply that it was simply not true that women were not permitted to say wear prayer shawls. And we learned that the daughters of Rashi, the very famous commentator in the 13th, 14th century, that those daughters wore the prayer, the special prayer straps called tefillin. And so knowing, being able to read about the past, so I would agree very strongly with you about having access to text changes the lot of women and changes everyone's understanding of tradition for the better, men and women both. In terms of women moving outside the home, in Jewish tradition, women were not always, were not homemakers. Men were sitting in the house of study, and women were the ones who were peddling, and who were outside the home doing shopping, doing selling, work, doing work. I mean, people didn't go out and earn a living to a factory. Much of what people did was in their own homes, and they would sell. So there hasn't been this change of Jewish women were once inside as 1950s housewives. And you know, and then they left. I would say also that I might question the way that you are equating the rise of divorce and women's being able to work outside the home, as if to say, you know, to make the conclusion that because women are not at home, marriages are falling apart. Certainly in the United States, scholars of the family are saying that when women make a living of their own, they can afford not to stay in unhappy marriages. They have the they have financial autonomy to choose a better life for themselves and for their if they're living in an intolerable environment, a better life for their children and the strength of their family as well. So I don't necessarily see, I mean, I you know, we can only speak about our own countries, but certainly in America, I don't see that the, and it's among American Jews, I don't see women working, women being rabbis and cantors and principals. I don't see that as weakening the Jewish family. If anything, I see that Jewish men, you know, again, speaking about my community, I see that, and I see that in the younger generation, among my younger colleagues and my son-in-law, my nephews, that Jewish men are developing their strengths in the home and are becoming more adept at transmitting a whole range of Jewish life skills and talents, not just the reading of prayers and sacred texts, but also learning language and song and teaching prayer, things that women more traditionally did. But thank you for your observations. Yes, John.
A Christian atheist is almost an oxymoron. And yet the word is being used. There are people who describe themselves as Christian non-theists. And that's nothing new to Judaism. And so since in so many things you all have gone through things ahead of us historically, I guess I've got a question about how are Jewish atheists faring in Israel with the whole question of who is a Jew? How are they faring? I don't know how to become a Jew as a Jewish atheist. Is that front being pushed among perhaps Jewish marriages where one partner is a non-ethnic Jew? They're both atheists, and they both want to become Jews.
Okay, I don't think I often hear the term Jewish atheist. I usually hear the term a secular Jew, and I think that's, or someone who's a cultural Jew. Atheist wasn't always used in polite conversation, was it? It's become popular lately. Well, as I know you know, John, to be a to one's Jewish membership is determined not by belief, it's determined by birth. And so if you were born of a Jewish mother, traditionally, if you were born of a Jewish mother, you're in. You can become a citizen, and I'll just take you through a few scenarios. You can become a citizen of Israel, you can and receive all the privileges and the responsibilities of citizenship. That is, if you're a Jewish woman, if you're a Jew, and if you marry a Jewish man, if you marry a non-Jewish man, your children are considered Jews, and it doesn't matter what they believe, and it doesn't matter who their father is. In the United States, So that's the situation in Israel. But that's not what you're asking me. You're asking me how does someone become a Jew who wants to be a member of the Jewish people but doesn't want to believe in God? And I think the answer to that question is best done on a Jewish comedy show. And I will have to get you this link. It's one of the funniest comedies. It was a late night comedy, in which in Israel, there are many people from the Philippines who've come and are working there, legally working there, and they are in the industry of caring for elderly parents in their homes. And one would call them foreign workers, but this this TV comedian calls them, sort of not quite understanding the word foreign, he uses strange. So he says, now I want to talk to you strange workers about how you can become Jewish. He says, first, you have to become really, really Jewish. You have to promise to, you men have to go snip, snip, and you have to say that you're going to follow all the laws of the food and the holidays and the Sabbath. He says, then over time, as time passes, you can become less Jewish. And then after more time passes, you can become plain Jewish, just like me. That is to say, a secular Jew. So I probably gave a messy way of explaining it. But to become a Jew, if you're an outsider, is one can only follow the rules of entry, which involve a formal conversion process, which would be done differently in the different denominations, but they are all about learning. Does one have to vow if you're going to become a conservative or a Reform Jew? In those denominations, and I preside at Reform conversions as one of the three in the court that decides whether the person's in or out. I've never in Charlottesville and Richmond have we ever said, do you believe? We have tested learning. We've tested fidelity. We've tested willingness to learn more and participate more. But we've never asked what do you believe. We have said, are you done with Christmas? And Jesus is certainly a no-no. But we've never tested belief.
My daughter married a North Baltimore Jewish boy. That doesn't have much to do with belief, but it does have to do with culture.
Oh, yes.
And the question I have, my grandson Avi had a bar mitzvah. Does that make him a Jew? Or how does he become a Jew if you have to have a Jewish mother to really be a Jew?
In the Reform movement, which I presume he's a member of the Reform, your daughter's husband is a member of the Reform movement. They in the last two decades came up with a different interesting notion that one's Jewishness was not just defined by who your mother was, but could be defined by who your father was. And as a matter of fact, in biblical times, Moses marries a Midianite, like not a nice Jewish girl. He marries a Midianite. So, and his child is considered a Jew. We see this again and again in the biblical scenario. So the Reform movement wasn't saying, oh, what the hell? You know, they were coming. They did find something previous in Jewish history that they could draw on. So my guess is that your grandson is in his movement, is considered a full-fledged Jewish boy, and he would have difficulty in his life only in two situations. One, if he wanted to move to Israel and be considered a citizen. And the rabbinate, which is Orthodox in nature in Israel right now, it isn't an equal opportunity rabbinate where conservative and reform rabbis are represented as well. They would say that that this child is not a Jew, and that in order to become Jewish, he would have to undergo a conversion ceremony, which they would be very happy to facilitate. They would be extremely happy to facilitate, but he would not be considered a Jew. The problem that this boy may find, another find, is if he decides to marry a conservative or an Orthodox Jew, a Jewish girl or a Jewish boy, case whatever it may be, and the rabbi performing that ceremony will say, "I only marry Jews, and I personally don't consider you, by virtue of your patrilineal descent, to be a member of good standing. However, I'd be more than happy, you know, be more than happy to do it, considering that you had a bar mitzvah already, and you know stuff, and you were raised as a Jew, to perform a to sign the right papers." So it's a very messy situation right now. All I can say, it's a messy bureaucracy, and it's not about someone saying, it's not about an individual saying, "But please, I've lived as a Jew, I believe as a Jew." It's not about a person's expression of their own expression of identity and belief. It's about joining a club, and every club has rules for admission for patrolling its borders, whether we like it or not. All I can do is just try and work to change the way that those rules are defined.
Well, I think we've had a fascinating time here together, and I want to thank you again, Vanessa, for coming and sharing tremendous lot of information to us and for your participation. And yes, let's give Vanessa another hand.
Thank you.